Hey, this is Brandon Curry, IFBB Pro, and you're listening to Advices Radio Network.
Welcome back to Drugs and Stuff. I'm Scott McDally. Of course, I'm with Dave Crossland, and today we have a special guest, Victoria Felkar. This program is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You can use our code ADVICES for some additional savings on high-quality supplements from a company that you can trust. Dave, we have to be on our best behavior. We have a lady with us today.
I will.
You put a shirt on today. That's a start.
I've got dressed today, which is a start. I'm not sat here in my white fronts and scratching my big fat beer belly.
Oh, man. Well, good to see you, great to have you here, Victoria. Thank you for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
So we thought this would be a really cool program to put together, Dave, because there's a lot of things that Victoria researches that I think you'd be interested in. For any of the viewers or listeners who aren't familiar with Victoria, tell me a little bit about yourself, for any of the new audience members that don't know who you are already.
Well, I am a researcher that is studying currently steroid use and all of its grand terms from an interdisciplinary perspective. So that means I study across disciplines. So the easiest way I can put it is I study steroids from cellular to social. And everything in between. And so my background is not only in more of what you call like the social sciences, so sociology and psychology, anthropology, but it's also in medicine and science. And so looking at things like actual pharmacology and what's going on at the cellular level, from endocrinology as well. And particularly my work focuses on women's health. But with that being said, I take everything that I can get when it comes to this topic. So not just women, also have looked at men.
All right. So I have some notes in front of me. These are your notes, actually. Mm-hmm. And, one of the big topics that we wanted to discuss was the state of research as far as anabolics, steroids go. This is something that, we recently, there was talk in another show saying that that there is no research out there on mm-hmm. anabolic steroids, and you felt though that you could share a slightly different perspective. Would you just mm-hmm. Care to start by elaborating on this?
Yeah. So, as a researcher, I guess first and foremost, I can say wholeheartedly that research is actually a really complicated process, and I think in the age of Google, the perception is that it's as easy as typing in some, whatever your search terms might be in Google and ending up with some either search pages, or if you're getting really kind of into it, you might go to Google Scholar. And this Google Scholar, for people that don't know, that's where you're going to find like academic articles, but also things that might be published in a peer-reviewed book. And so that's the perception that, like, it's as easy as X, Y, Z. Research isn't that simple. If it was that simple, everybody would be walking around with a PhD. That's not the case. And that's not saying that PhDs are all legitimate. I mean, definitely there are some that it's questionable, but that there's a reason why as a researcher, you have to go into like methodology courses. You have to be trained in a skill set. That is a skill, it is a profession. So I think that one of the things I always caution people when they ask me about this topic, even my students when I teach, is like, if you're just using a single search engine, that's what we would consider in the research world as being really not good practice. If you're just using single, what we would call a search term, so say typing into Google, anabolic steroid side effects, and only doing one search with those single search terms, we wouldn't consider that to be good practice. And so there's a lot of things and I think ideas that get built upon in the industry, especially with regards to steroid use, that are built off these very kind of distorted perceptions of what they believe the state of the research is based off of these mediocre at best research methodologies. And I mean, Scott, you've been in my life as I've been doing this massive, massive review, and you've seen just how much work and frustration it can be, even for a trained researcher, that it is a really, really involved process. So, I mean, with all that being said, I think one of the first things for people who say might want to research anabolic steroids, know that in research, they're not actually called anabolic steroids. That's an incorrect term. It's anabolic androgenic steroid. synthetic androgens. And if they are called anabolic steroids, I'll type that in the search too. So just to be wary of things like that. And also to know that not all the research you find is very good. And that's really, I think Dave and I touched on that a little earlier when we were getting introduced, that there is a lot of really shitty research on anabolic androgenic steroid use.
Really? How so? How is it shitty?
So, for example, a lot of studies rely on either interviews, so face-to-face discussions, or on survey data, or they rely on kind of building upon a previously made theory. So Dave could have done a study in the 1980s on steroid use using a survey with a very specific group of individuals, say 12 males in the UK that were all former Olympic athletes. And he used a very kind of only five questions to get this massive finding that he then reported. And 20 years later, Scott, you then go and pick up this research that Dave did and you do what we would call a review on it. And then you would build your own theory based off of Dave's. And then that is called an experimental study, which is not true. Okay. And it just keeps, it's almost like that game of telephone when you, I don't know if you guys played that as a kid, where you whisper something in somebody's ear and then they whisper it to the person next to them and next to them. And then at the end of the game, say there's 20 kids sitting there, the kid says what they heard and it's nothing like what the first person said. I mean, that is...
I never had enough friends to play that game.
we played it in school, so I guess we kind of got paired with people. I really didn't have friends either. I liked books better. So I think that's also a really big piece of the research on steroid use is that it's kind of this misinformation.
It's not just that though as well. I mean, it took academia 50 years to agree that if you increase the dose, you get a greater yield of effect.
Absolutely.
And that, one of the problems that I find regularly, I work quite a lot with a guy called Jim McVeigh, who's a UK researcher. And I will say things to Jim. And I'll say, look, I'm very observation-based, as we were discussing before we went live, that a lot of my findings is observation-driven. So I'll see patterns in usage. I'll see patterns in people. And then I go looking for the evidence to support that. And I spoke to Jim about stuff 3-4 years ago that he completely shitballed. But now, because there's been studies after studies done on this stuff, he'll now have a conversation about it. You get researchers that, unless it's in black and white, they won't theorize. They won't put their arm out and have a look at problems like that. And it stagnates the process because research should come from ideas. It should come from, I wonder, let's go and see if it's true.
And that's a
problem. Unfortunately, it doesn't for a lot of people because it's funding based and they want to secure funding. So they want to secure something that's safe. And as a result of that, you get studies that, are basically, you know, when you go for a shit, you may potentially get poo on your bum, which means you might need to wipe your ass. The results are so fucking obvious. But they just regurgitate it because it provides us a wage.
And I think another big thing, too, is that there are different what we'd call like research positions or stances, and that a lot of the research that is done doesn't take into consideration where not only like preconceived notions come from. So if, say, you grew up in the era of drugs are bad, steroids are bad, you're going to take them, you're going to become a criminal because you're taking them. If you've grown up with that kind of like ethos around you, that does leach into your research. I mean, it's bias. And as a researcher, we have a kind of an unwritten rule that you are supposed to declare that type of information. But that's more in what, like the social sciences versus like the hard science, unfortunately. And because a lot of the hard science is what people associate with like drug research, it's the people that are either physicians or pharmacologists or biochemists or whatever it might be, that then there becomes this really big disconnect. And I find that when it comes to like androgen use specifically, I mean, in any type of reproductive hormone particularly, there are so many myths and misconceptions that have been embedded in steroids since the onset. So since the drugs were even synthesized back in the 20s and the 30s, even before that, when they were first kind of trying to be figured out what was going on in the late 1800s, 1900s. And these ideas still remain in research today. And that's one of the biggest things that I've been trying to tackle with my PhD. And so, for example, we know testosterone are in individuals across different ages, different sexes, different backgrounds. We know that this is a hormone that exists in people regardless of if they're male or female. Unfortunately, today, it still gets associated as the male sex hormone. And that's just, that's not true. It's scientifically incorrect. But if you go into your research thinking that, you know what, synthetic androgen is a male hormone, therefore, if women take it, it's going to result in X, Y, and Z, that's a bad, ugly bias that then is going to get leached into your work. And in academic fashion, we have to cite other people to support our theories. It then gets passed down throughout time. And unfortunately, when it comes to steroid use, there has been such an impact from things like the anti-doping movement that we've associated testosterone not for health purposes. We've associated it as an enhancing drug, an optimizing drug. And because of that, it's kind of had this one type of rhetoric. Whereas for estrogen and progesterone, we had a completely other type of rhetoric, even though they're all steroids. And that as a result of that, it's changed things like legal implications of use. It's changed things like clinical guidelines of use. It's changed things like side effects of use and perceptions of it, risk of use. And so we cloud different research based off of all these things. And I know from where I'm at as an interdisciplinary research, my job is to pull the shit off of it and figure out.
Don't mind Dave. He's a very busy man. He has lots of calls coming in.
What's going on at the surface level and where these ideas came from. But yeah. I'm one of a few researchers that do that type of detailed work. So I guess going back to Scott, your question, like, why is it? What's going on? Why is it so bad? Here's just an idea. Say Dave was doing a research study and he wanted to look at, I don't know, male users. Male recreational steroid use in bodybuilders in the UK. And he just wanted to get an idea of what type of effects these drugs are having.
Okay.
Well, one of the big things that I've seen in the research, and this is based off of a study that I can't talk about in too much detail yet, but I will be able to once it's published. What happens is that a lot of times anabolic steroids get homogenized as one singular drug. And so instead of saying, you know what, this individual used Tren and they were on EQ and they were on testosterone and this user was on Sustanon and they were on MPP, what happens is all these drugs just get called synthetic androgens. And they get looked at one massive, massive drug category instead of actually looking at each individual user, what drugs they took and the implications of use. Not only that, they're getting drugs from a black market source. I can tell you that very rarely is that even listed as a potential variable that would influence somebody's effects or side effects.
And as we well know, we can be looking at almost 50% of those drugs aren't what they're supposed to be.
Absolutely. And so if you're trying to do a study, let's just say you were only getting men on MPP, you're only looking at that and you wanted users that just had used that. Well, if you have 15 users and three of them maybe use the same source, but even that, who the hell knows what they're getting? And now you're trying to make claims based off of what this drug is doing when users are all using it different amounts. They have different starting places of use. Their drugs might not be pure. We don't know about other variables that we know influence how somebody, say, metabolizes a drug. But regardless of all these, and I mean, I could go on and on and on, but regardless of all these variables, then a conclusion gets built and that conclusion gets published and off it goes into the world of research and science. I find that that's incredibly damning, yet nobody seems to be talking about that in the research world when it comes to steroid use.
It is a big problem area as well because of the ethics side of all this. You can't take 50 individuals and ram them full of pharma grade steroids because you would never get it past an ethics board in a million years.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm Ingrid's work out of Oslo.
Yeah.
She does record dosing, but she doesn't record drug types. And it's a massive flaw in what she's done. Because it's like, so, you know, we have no indication that we're seeing damage in the brain. We're seeing changes in the brain. We're seeing this. Is this from a gram of test or is this from 500 mega test and 500 mega trend? Mm-hmm. What's driving this forward? Because we know it's not equal. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And we know just coming from basic user feedback that, that trenbolone is the most powerful mentally stimulating drug that we use in our arsenal of steroids. We have more people problems with that than any other drug, hands down, massively so. I know you've looked at female use in particular, and I would suspect that within female use, the drug purity is a massive problem because one of the big aspects of female use is virilization.
Mm-hmm.
And yet two of the most common drugs for being something else are Anavar and Primo, which are the two most popular drugs for female use. You know, you can't even look at virilization in females through drug use because you can't quantify that the source and purity of the drug they're using is correct.
Not only that, you're also looking at women that are fucking magicians with things like hair removal. And so there are studies that have been done that researchers have actually, and number one, this is really biased, but they'll go in going, we're going to look at these women. We're going to do like a observation of what they look like and look for steroid use, which is that in itself is awful research practice. But two, they're going, we're going to look to see if we can find virilization. Women are magicians when it comes to hair removal, when it comes to trying to hide and cover up certain side effects. So it was really interesting because that study actually was very well funded, done by a very kind of importantly perceived person in the steroid world of research. And it's then results get pushed out into that world and republished and republished. And I think for me, I have to laugh because with that whole kind of division between, say, like bro science or and actual science or evidence-based, you know what, when it comes to this topic, nobody's a fucking expert. None of us are, because there are so many variables involved. And then people that are in the industry aren't experts. People that are in research aren't experts, because this is a relatively not only new subject. We've got to remember that steroids were only synthesized. I mean, estrogen was like 1927, 1928. Testosterone was 1936. That's not that long ago. Two, they're really hard to research because of all these confounding variables. Three, we're dealing with a lot of black market use. And then people also create ideas just based off of what they think is going to happen, right? Yeah, I mean, the form syndrome, while somebody goes like, I'm going to go on the form and I'm going to read what all these other guys took. And then I'm going to do that same cycle and I'm going to elicit the same results. I have this preconceived notion. And then now I'm going to suddenly build theories and ideas off of that. Well, that's just not the way research works. And bros are doing it. But then, as I just mentioned, researchers are doing that too. And so I think to kind of go into this type of work with this really this critical lens of going, okay, if I read a study, I have to know, like, what am I reading? Where did they get these results from? Let's look at where they have cited sources from. Let's look at the research methods. So my sister, I'm very blessed, was a librarian as I was going through my undergrad and into my master's and PhD, but she always called it information literacy. So be armed and actually ask yourself what you're reading. And go outside just the world of steroids, like go into the research that's done in TRT. Obviously, it's not super physiological dosing, but we can still get certain theories that might then be able to be applied. But if you watch, my language is really general because they're just, this is not a black and white topic. It is so gray.
Not at all. And we, as from the other end, as people involved in the industry from a user's perspective, we look at studies and we really do grasp at straws. I mean, I remember when Novadex was cited as reducing IGF-1. So everybody stopped Novadex and everybody jumped on much harsher AIs for their estrogen management. And then they were having problems with cholesterol problems because the estrogen was getting so low. They were having problems with libido because the estrogen was low. They weren't stimulating growth. All because one study said Novadex reduces IGF. and didn't compensate for the fact that steroids massively increase IGF. And so the net loss wasn't even tangible. But the whole, you saw a big, huge switch in trend towards people not using Novadex anymore.
Yeah.
And it's silly things like this that actually have serious health implications on the user community.
Absolutely.
Because you get some knobhead who wants to sound special and wants to sound intelligent, who's bit read a report or read the conclusion of the brief and not bothered look and not bothered had a holistic view of that report on whether that actually information is viable.
Yeah.
And it gets pushed out there and pushed out there. You get a few names behind it, and then before you know it, everybody's jumping on the bandwagon. And I've made that mistake myself in my earlier days, you know, of picking up bits of information and running with it before I've actually fully encompassed everything that's going on. The whole research area is problematic because in the vast majority, we're looking at repurposing research from something else and trying to shoehorn it into a hole of what we're doing, which isn't really what's going on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And we get back to that old adage that, you know, the very old saying of the difference between a poison and a medicine is dose. And you get people say, well, you know, I've seen research that TRT is health beneficial, so therefore I can run 2 grams a test. Whoa, that's a big fucking stretch, mate.
Well, I mean, in research,
you literally get that.
Yeah, that's called cherry picking. And that's not exactly what would be considered to be a good research methodology. It obviously depends on what the research is and everything else. But I can say that as a researcher, I am challenged on a daily basis by what my colleagues are sometimes doing and saying. But I'm also equally challenged by hearing what industry people are doing and saying. So... Yeah, it kind of puts you in a weird place.
Do you? I don't know if it's the same over there. I know the States is a little bit more active in research with steroid use than the UK is. But I find myself ever frustrated by the level of not just shit poor research, but by the level of the fact is research something that's useful. Instead of researching and regurgitating old crap that we've talked about for the last 5-10 years, and is to be honest, to anyone with half a brain cell, completely fucking obvious. Stop being safe. It frustrates the hell out of me that researchers are safe.
Well,
because they want to secure their funding, because they don't want to upset any apple carts, and they want an easy life. So, you know, we'll study something that we already know the answers to and just put it down on a bit of paper in a different fucking way.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to a bigger issue in academia of the fact that there's this whole kind of notion of publish or perish. So meaning that if you don't publish, your career is gone. And that's what drives, like, publishing drives hiring practices. It drives pay practices. It drives everything in academia. And so there are lots of researchers that take that literally and go, okay, well, I just need to regurgitate. I need to just pump. Keep pushing stuff out. And then there's also issues too with the actual publishing practices that it's said that it's peer reviewed, but even that process is very shifty. So, I mean, that speaks to something so much bigger. And for me, I am from the stance that if I do good work, that's all that matters to me. I've had to kind of walk away from the ideas of, like, if something gets published or not, what my impact factor might be or any of that kind of crap that you hear in academia, and just go, like, if I know I'm doing good work, then, and I'm putting everything into it, everything is incredibly rigorous. It might take me 3 times as long. But if I know that I'm able to say, like, I can stand behind my results fully and wholeheartedly, then I'm good. I can wipe my hands and walk away.
Personal question. Would you go out on a limb if you declared that you were going out on a limb when you did so with a theory of something that you see that you think is a potential possibility, or would you always never put that theory out there if you couldn't support it wholeheartedly?
It depends on the setting and depends on the what the context of that is. So if I get asked, say, a question that I can go, okay, here is my answer. However, this comes with a caveat that this answer is based off of theory. It's based off of my own like personal stance as a researcher, my experience, and that I can say that there is actually nothing research-wise backing this, but there's a whole bunch of other factors that have brought me to this conclusion. And so, yes. Now, in the academic world, honestly, it depends on where and what I'm doing. In my own research with my PhD, I'm doing that all the time, Dave. Like, I literally have a sentence that is, like, over and over again going, there is no research to support this. However, based off of, we are really good with the word, like, therefore, however, notwithstanding. Those are, like, academic punch phrases that you use all the time. That Scott laughs at me more because I use those in actual speaking, too. Yeah, and I think too, like one of the things I hold very close to my heart, not only as a researcher but also somebody in the industry, is that when I don't know, I believe it's my ethical and moral position to tell people that I don't know. I'm not going to be one of those individuals that try to postulate based off of, you know, complete bullshit and utter fluff. If I don't know something, I will say that, but then I will also often say, like, but let me find out, or let me direct you to somebody that does know. Because it's not worth, number one, somebody getting hurt, somebody getting sick, somebody getting led down some, you know, chase for an answer that doesn't even exist. And two, for me personally, I believe that when I put information out to the world, that's my responsibility. It's like a child of mine that I need to be very careful about what I put out, and also ensure that that, obviously, I can't control what other people do with it, but that I have to make sure that, again, going back to what I, when I publish things, if I know I did good work, I can stand behind that. I couldn't stand behind something that was, you know, a theory that was built on nothing but preconceived notions of what something could be.
But you're willing to postulate a theory in the fact that you think there's a link or potential to this being driven by this or whatever it might be.
As long as I could back that up, yes. Okay. I mean, that's a hypothesis.
But you can back that up by saying, this is just a theory, this is just an idea or a hypothesis based on these, I did, I mean, a long time ago now, but I did a video on taking responsibility for advice because I was sick of hearing people give out advice that, in my opinion, was poor. That doesn't mean it was incorrect. It was just, in my opinion, it was poor, because that is a lot of what this is based on, is just the opinion. But the fact that they weren't going to be there to pick up the pieces afterwards. If you give someone advice, you've got to be willing to stand there if that advice backfires.
Absolutely, 100%.
And I don't, one of the things I don't like about a lot of the internet gurus is that they pump stuff out that, and they're not willing to back that up when it goes wrong.
Absolutely.
Or they're unrealistic with the information they pump out. I mean, I know a few people whose knowledge is very, very credible, and I get what they're trying to say. But it's just, it's, that's never going to be delivered in a real world environment because people are just not going to make that much effort into safeguarding themselves. I mean, I come very much more from a harm reduction background and a harm management background in, what I do. But harm reduction only works if it's implemented. And you cannot overcomplicate. And so sometimes you've got to look at the bigger picture in the, you've got to allow a certain element of poor practice if, in order to reduce the overall harms, it's effective, rather than trying to ultra-manage someone's usage to the point that you switch them off that much, they just don't bother with anything. And so, you know, sometimes there are generalizations in harm reduction because you've got to look at the bigger picture. You know, I'm not going to stop you from drinking while you're on gear. I'm not going to stop you from recreational drugs. So what I'm going to advise is that you remove this element or that element and I'll let the rest slide. Because if I try and stop you doing everything, you're not going to listen to anything.
But let me jump in here for just a second, because it sounds like we're in a great place to kind of shift to our second topic, which is harm reduction. But before we do that, I just want to ask, okay, so what I'm taking away here is that there is some information out there. There are some studies out there. There is information that we can draw from. And from that information, there is some good information probably, but there's also some bad information. And really, that's a take-home message that I'm getting from this. So say you take an average guy like myself and I say, hey, I want to try to learn more. I want to try to educate myself. I go to Google Scholar and I start trying to do my own research. How can I determine whether what I'm looking at is going to be good or whether it's going to be a bunk, regurgitated, bad information? What can you suggest to us, you know, to because I feel like so far we've gotten a warning that just because you see a study, which this is something Dr. Scott Stevenson has talked a lot about too, and he's debunked several studies on muscle minds. You know, how can we as we'll just say like your average bro learn to better pick through what we're reading and make these decisions for ourselves?
Well, I think, like I said initially, researching is a skill. So I don't want to come off as being completely an asshole and elitist and going leave it to the experts, because as I just also said, the experts really don't always know what they're doing.
Okay.
But I will say that that's something to remember too. You know, maybe it's not as a critical kind of skill set as doing like neurosurgery, but it still is definitely some education that will help to elicit the best understanding and knowledge synthesis. So one of the things that I always suggest people do is, number one, like, determine what information is needed. So if you have a research question that you make, like, I don't know what it might be, but I don't know, why is the sky blue? Okay, so determine what type of information you need to actually answer that question. Do you need research studies? If you do, what type of field do you need them from? Access the information. But if you are somebody that only has access to Google Scholar, realize that there are going to be some barriers to that. So guess what? And this is mind-blowing for people. Libraries still exist. And even if you're even if you're not a university student, you can go to the library and ask the librarian for help. And you're able to use the databases. Another big thing that people forget is that universities have an internet-wide, kind of a campus internet-wide. And if you go and you research on a campus, you're going to get vastly different search results than if you're at home because of the VPNs. So if people want to do a little like research sleuthing of sorts, go to your local university campus and access their Wi-Fi with the guest login, and you're going to get a lot better results. You're going to be able to actually read studies, not just get the abstracts just based off of that.
No kidding.
I mean, get the help that you need, obviously. Learn how to evaluate sources. And there's lots of different things that you can go online and find just for, like, you know, type in information literacy for research, and they will give you sets of questions to use to help you critically evaluate. So, for example, what is this research on? Did they actually answer the question that they were setting out to do? Who did this research? If it was a study on, let's say, bodybuilder steroid use, and you have a bunch of, biophysiologists that have no idea of the underworld of steroid use and haven't commented on any of those variables, then you might want to start to question those results. So learn how to actually evaluate the sources. And then also think about things like who said it, when it was said, why it was said. So was there funding? So the last line of a lot of studies at the very, very end, after they've done their conclusion, they have to list whether or not this study was funded, who it was funded by, and sometimes even what the purpose of that is. Obviously, this doesn't always get done. But if you see that there's a study that's being constantly funded by, say, an anti-doping organization on steroid juice, you might want to also consider that as how you're going to evaluate that source. So I guess at the end of the day, what I can say is brush up on your information literacy skills. There's lots of resources available. But even when you're armed with those, you're still not going to be you're still not going to have everything you need to possibly walk away with the answers that you want.
Fair enough.
A lot of people look at research from a point of view of supporting a decision they're looking to make.
Yes.
Yeah, I can see that.
So when you're going to do that, don't look for research that supports your decision. Look for research that goes against your decision.
Okay.
Because then if you struggle to find evidence that goes against your decision, you can have some confidence that your decision may be to some degree correct. Where And that's what people don't do. People always look to support their argument. Where if you're truly looking at this correctly, you should be looking to disprove your argument.
Hmm. Yeah.
And if you can't disprove your argument, then there's more merit in what your argument may be.
Interesting. So, that's a great point.
You know, looking at the correct research, evaluating the research, and funding, definitely. I mean, you're not going to get refunded by WADA if the research you funded did not support their agenda. They're not giving you any more money.
Yeah.
And whether you want to believe it or not, the bottom line is researchers do that for a living.
Yeah.
If they start getting a reputation for upsetting the funding body,
yeah,
they're not going to get a lot more research, and they're going to go very hungry.
Wow, this is so much. This is so much more than just reading the headline of the study and you know, reading the abstract. So
there used to be a.
What's that?
Don't just read the abstract.
There used to be a very good Russian site where you could type in the numeric code for the study and it would give you the whole study for free. Unfortunately, it's gone down again. But that used to be really, really useful because you could get all the studies for fuck all.
I may have heard about that site.
Yeah.
From someone.
It was good with that site. All right. It's gone down last time I tried it, so I don't know if it's back up again or not now. But is it down?
All right.
It was useful, was that?
Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends. And they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com. And use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows.
Let's switch to the second topic, which was risk management, because I know, Victoria, this is something that I think, you know, something that you've really been passionate about. I feel like it, as far as just health in general, and especially when we talked about like females and reproductive system and keeping hormonal health, that's really, I think, been a big topic of yours. And this is obviously, it's a big topic of Dave's. Dave does, you know, a lot of talks with the UK military and, you know, on risk management for not only anabolic and androgenic steroids, but also for, you know, recreational drugs and alcohol too. So let's kick this off. So first of all, Where do we want to start this one, Victoria?
I guess I was going to say, I was going to start off by saying I overthink everything, so my answer is probably going to be really complex compared to Dave's movie. But,
I made a career out of giving simple answers.
But I will say that I also, so when I talk about like risk management, I also look at oral contraceptive use or other types of hormones or hormonal agents that women in particular use. So not just looking at androgens, I look at, you know, anti-estrogens, SARMs, peptides, fertility drugs, contraceptive drugs, all that stuff. Yeah. And so that's kind of where my perspective is more crafted over. And I think one of the things that, like, when I do talk about the subject that I try to get through to people's brains right away is that often drug use is thought of in a very, what's called a reductionist point of view, which means, like, I take this and it's going to elicit this response. And it's almost just like an arrow.
Yeah.
A plus B equals C. But we know that that's not what happens physiologically, and that it really is chaos, essentially, that happens within our body, that there is so many different responses, so many different reactions that happen that aren't often thought about. And so I don't know if you guys have ever seen those posters that are like, this is what success, people think success looks like, and it's like just an arrow, mm-hmm. and then it's like, this is what success actually looks like, and it's just massive squiggle. Yeah. And so that's kind of what drug use is within our body, is that there is a whole bunch of things that get either activated or that get, you know, certain types of receptors that get modified, or numerous different things. And so that just to remind themselves that right away, you know, you might take Anavar thinking you're going to grow a bigger booty, but that the reality is that's the farthest thing that's going to happen. Muscle growth is only one outcome potentially of numerous things that compound can do to the body. And that a lot of the ideas in particular, as it relates to my work, say about androgens, are often kind of glamorized within the fitness industry. And that also needs to be factored into somebody's decision to use, not to use, to go on, off, manipulate certain cycles or hormones. And then same thing with something like, let's just say the oral contraceptive pill. It's often not glamorized. It's often just completely thought of as a very simple drug with a simple response, and that's all that there is. And that, again, there's a lot more complexities to it, and there's a lot more things happening within the body that don't always get noted.
Oversimplification and acceptance is something that is very problematic in risk management. A prime example of this is to hear male users talk about shutdown. Mm-hmm. You talk to male users about having to be on TRT, and it's very much just a case of, yeah, you know, well, I've used gear, so I have to run TRT now. They don't comprehend the implications of being drug dependent for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
And even more so, they don't comprehend the implications of using a UGL drug source for the rest of their life, which is even more worrying. It's normalized. And a lot of the side effects we experience are normalized. You speak to any medical professional and say, this individual is going to take a compound that's going to cause them to be drug dependent for the rest of their life, and they'll look at you in absolute horror and go, are they a complete fucking idiot?
Yeah,
you speak to a steroid user about being reliant on TRT, and they actually think it's a bonus.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of self-diagnosing, self-treating TRT people fuck it up, and they fuck it up constantly. Because they don't run at the correct levels. I probably look at in the region of 15 to 100 sets of bloods a week now. And every single one, without exception, if they're a user, has high blood values. RBC, hematocrit, they're all elevated. That in itself is a medical condition that has grave cause for concern long term. And yet I'm seeing it across the board in users, and users are not paying it much attention because they're running TRT. They're getting elevated RBC when they're on cycle. They're then dropping into their cruiser TRT. But because they're running the super pharmacologicals, even in their TRT, they're sitting there. Their levels above range, they might not be massively elevated, but they're still above range. Those levels aren't dropping, and then they go on cycle and it's compounded again, and it's just constantly rising and rising and rising. And when they start getting into their 40s and 50s, they're going to start seeing massive health implications of that. Blood clots, poor circulation, kidney failure, enlarged heart failure, heart myocardium malformations. You know, all these sort of things are going to come off the back of the fact that their RBC was elevated for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing to risk management is knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. That's like for me when I talk to people about risk management, the first place I start is I like call it like the step one is understand the situation. And so, and I literally try to make it as simple as possible. And I go understand the person, like the user and their body and the numerous intra individual factors. So who they are, what they're doing, why they're doing it. But not only that, are they sleeping? How's their diet? Have they taken other types of hormones in the past? For women, do they have a regular menstrual cycle? If not, why?
Are they using recreational drugs? Are they using alcohol? Are there other poisonous factors in their life?
Factors. Do they have a stable their stress levels? Do they have any other type of maybe genetic or inherited types of chronic illnesses, or have they had any type of acute illnesses in their past? So learn the individual and then also learn the drug, not just from the bodybuilding knowledge, but learn the drug. There's the new kind of era of pharmacology is called systems pharmacology. I love it. I mean, again, Scott's seen all of my really crazy whiteboards on this stuff, but it literally looks at when a drug is utilized, what are all the different pathways that it's doing within the body? And then taking it that step further, what are all these different pathways and how are they interacting with that drug? Because it's a two-way relationship. And then
one of the problems with steroids is we just don't know where all the pathways are yet with some of them. I mean, we're still learning.
We don't know. The human body is like space. You look up in the sky, we know all of a few planets and that's it. We really don't know a lot about the human body, and our knowledge is constantly changing. Just like when you look up in the sky, there's infinite things. And so all we can do is to go into that with the idea that I can build some knowledge, but even then my knowledge is not concrete. And I think that's one of the funny things, actually going back to the whole research thing, is that people perceive science to be absolute. They perceive it to be perfect. And
it's developing.
They're
ever moving.
Not only that, is that science is somebody's personal opinion at the end of the day. Somebody analyzed those results. Somebody made those results. Somebody decided what methods to be used. It is still somebody's personal opinion. And so, though, going back to the whole kind of risk management thing, for me, it is to go okay, understand the situation here. Let's look at the person and look at all theirs, because especially when it comes to women, there are so many myths and misconceptions around women's health and women's bodies that I have to first teach different types of professionals about before I can even get into the drug stuff. Because even the idea that, women all have this utopian, perfect 28-day menstrual cycle is a myth. And that has to be talked about first before I can get into the other things. Looking at how hormones are influenced, looking at how hormones are made. I mean, I think I talked about this before on the show, Scott, with you, is looking at the process of steroid genesis within the body and how people don't even recognize how steroids are made within our body and how if they take, an androgen, how it's going to affect things not only down chain, so estrogen. People always talk about this, aromatization as this big thing, but there's many different directions. I mean, steroids go down, go to the side, they go to the other side, and they go up. And so,
and it's not just your traditional hormones that you're talking about. I mean, males. Males produce HCG.
Yeah.
It's a natural common for our body. We stop producing that when we take anabolics.
Yeah.
So there's all the other chemicals that we produce in our hormone cycles that are interrupted when we take anabolics.
Absolutely.
We produce levels of progesterone. That's and this is where, you can obviously end up micromanaging this stuff and getting too anal about it, and it becomes unrealistic to expect an average individual to implicate that. But without doubt, the biggest driving factor behind risk management is knowledge. And because you need to be able to perceive the risk. You can't perceive the risk if you don't know what the risk is.
Absolutely.
Now, for some people, the exposure to anabolics in regards to its risk exposure and their perceived reward from that, that you then start to look at the mental health, the mental physical risk of taking AAS against the perceived mental health reward of taking AAS. And it gets even more complex then, because people's risk reward ratios change. I know people that take anabolics that if they don't, their mental health suffers so extremely due to lack of confidence. They don't leave the house. They don't interact socially. They don't hold a job. They don't hold relationships. But by using anabolics, and it's obviously a crutch drug, but by using anabolics, they're able to function as a positive member of society, which they couldn't do before, because it gives them confidence.
Wow.
So it's such a complex subject matter. It's not just a case of these drugs create harms and you need to be aware of these harms, because there are positive aspects to drug use in certain individuals, and it can be quite beneficial to certain individuals. And I'm not talking about a medical, I'm talking about steroid abuse, technically. Mm-hmm. It's actually beneficial to some individuals because of their set of circumstances. So it is a really complex subject, but the key driving factor behind it all is knowledge. You have to be aware, and we have a growing trend, and we've discussed this before, Scott. We have a growing trend of looking at bloods, mm-hmm. but at the same time, we have a growing trend of dismissing the blood results.
Yeah,
right. You're asking the right questions, but you're not listening to the answers. So why bother asking the questions in the first place? You're no further down the road. You're no better off than you would have been if you'd never done the blood test in the first place. Mm-hmm. Because you're not reacting to it, you're not managing it. Mm-hmm. So it is, and I think the other problem we have, which I started to see change, and I don't know if this is the same in the States as it is over in the UK. I see people die because of steroid use. But you say, you do a search, and as many search engines as you want, how many people die from steroid abuse a year, and the numbers that come back will be so minimal, it will be hardly recognizable. Mm-hmm. Because medical profession at this point is not connecting the dots. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we're now starting to see change. And I think over the next 5 years, we will start to see much more connectivity be between symptom and use from a medical standpoint. And as a result, that knowledge will then radiate out a bit more, and people will start to see in black and white that these drugs do cause kidney problems, these drugs do cause kidney failure, these cause heart attack, they do actually kill people.
Yeah.
If you don't respect them, and if you aren't wary of what their potential is. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, people are dying of steroid abuse, and no, they're dying of a genetic heart defect, or they're dying of an enlarged heart, or they're dying of a heart attack. And a lot of that's driven by finances, because they just don't want to look any further. They've got the cause of death. That's the 200 quid autopsy done. We're not going any further because you're not paying for any more. Mm. And people forget that, you know, that when someone dies, if they can find a cause of death that satisfies everybody, they're not digging anymore because nobody's spending that money. Mm-hmm. But I think we will. So I don't know if you'll see. Are you seeing changes of attitude in the States from medical professionals towards the impacts of usage, or have you seen it still quite disconnected?
It's fragmented. It's really, really fragmented, because you'll have some users that might be a little bit, say, more open-minded about TRT, yet they disconnect, you know, TRT from synthetic androgens as a whole. One of the things that, I can give maybe Scott you some stuff for the show, but there are certain like databases that are publicly accessible that look at like the curated associations, say, with androgen use, synthetic androgen use, and then the inferred associations. So things like cardiovascular disease. So where are the studies, so the curated studies on the link between cardiovascular disease and synthetic androgens, and what are the inferred associations? And you look at like the synthetic androgen one, and there are like 25% or above, curated and equally inferred. But then you look at like mental disorder, like what Dave, you just talked about. There are zero curated associations with synthetic androgens in the research that they have identified with this database. But there's over 20% of the literature they're saying the ideas are inferred. So what I'm trying to get at is that there are medicine also creates these inferred associations with certain drugs that really aren't substantiated, but they dwindle it down to clinical, it's my clinical experience, therefore I can say that androgens equate to, kidney disease, even though we don't have the literature on that, and we talked about that before. But what I'm trying to get at here is that you look at the anabolic steroid one, or the synthetic androgens, and then you look over at, which is my other line of like research, the oral contraceptives, and there are so many curated associations between it. You know, many of the same effects that are associated with synthetic androgens, but they are not being paid attention to by the medical profession at all. And so when we think about synthetic, let's say oral androgen use, and how people, you know, go like, oh my God, your liver is going to get all fucked up from taking this oral drug, when that is a synthetic steroid. An oral contraceptive is also a synthetic steroid. Liver effects happen from oral contraceptives, very similar pathways that they do from synthetic androgens. Yet nobody is paying attention to that. And why I bring this up is I can't tell you how many female users I have crossed paths with that have either were on a contraceptive or are on a contraceptive simultaneous to not only using something like Anavar or Winstrol, but also SARMs and anti-estrogens. And they wonder why they're sick and they're unwell. And that, but we don't think about that. That same conversation is not had for women as it is for men. I think I get really frustrated when I hear, you know, people talking about, say, heart issues in male users, but nobody's talking about heart issues in female users. It's like there's this invincibility complex that drives me insane because that's just not the way these drugs work.
The female user perspective has been very much ignored. From both a research point of view and in general, and partly to do with the fact that generally females are very reluctant to admit usage. So the user levels within females are very misconstrued because we haven't seen the data come forward of actually how many females are using. They're getting more open. Females are starting to be more open about their use, but they're still very secretive about it. And unfortunately, particularly in the fitness classes, and yet the fitness classes is probably where the biggest level of misuse is occurring. Absolutely. Because they're much more ignorant to the effects of the drugs. With the physique girls, yeah, they might use more drugs and they might use harsher and stronger drugs, but they also have a better idea of what they're getting into. Whereas the bikini girls and the fitness girls generally don't have a clue. They just take it because she does or the coach said I had to. And they're very driven that way. And their knowledge base is poor. And there's no just way of getting out of that. It just is. Yeah. And they're probably a much bigger risk group than the physique competitors are that might be actually banging in a couple hundred mega tests a week. I mean, I've seen some pretty high user levels in certain females. And I've seen certain females with some particularly high user levels with actually quite low levels of virilization. And it's like, how?
Yeah.
You know? And I've seen females absolutely trashed off 20 milligram of Anavar.
I can answer those questions. I mean, a lot of that comes down to what I said at the beginning. We have to look at the individual. We have to look at the drug.
Yeah.
If somebody's individual levels, say, let's say, of androgens are relatively low, they're not very stressed, so they're like adrenal androgen levels aren't going to be super high. If they have, say, really normal menstrual cycle, they're an ovulatory menstrual cycle for their entire life, that everything is, you know, great. It will have a very different effect of a drug than somebody who has, say, irregular menstrual cycle, high levels of stress, gastric issues, high levels of inflammation, insulin resistance, all of these different things. The body's going to respond to that drug very differently. And I can say Scott knows, I don't say things very often like to a very generalized statement that all the listeners like when I get down to this, but if a female takes an synthetic androgen, she is inducing many times a hyperandrogenic state. So she is inducing what we would call in medicine hyperandrogenism.
And what does that mean?
It's from an exogenous source. Most of us have heard about what PCOS is, or polycystic ovarian syndrome. Polycystic ovarian syndrome is this, I mean, it's a very bad name, medical diagnosis, drives me nuts because it's a cluster of symptoms, but the main cluster of symptoms is hyperandrogenism. So when female users all of a sudden say, I have PCOS, they've induced that themselves. Like, that is what you've just done. Full stop. You have induced a state of high androgens. What do you think is going to happen? Hair growth is not a side effect, it's an effect. High cholesterol is not a side effect, it is an effect. This is what happens when you take these drugs. So stop calling them side effects, because that's not what they are. They are an effect. An irregular cycle.
I think people view them as side effects because they're an effect to the side of what their primary reason for using the drug is.
But at the end of the day, they're not a side effect. They are.
No, I get your point there.
They are.
I mean, I get frustrated when people say, oh, well, they blame a drug for a certain effect. And it's like, no. And especially if it's a negative effect. And I say, no, it's not the drug's fault. It's your poor management of the drug that's causing that effect.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't get water retention with aromatizing drugs if you manage their use correctly. It's when you mismanage their use, you get water retention from aromatizing drugs because you don't manage the aromatization of the drug.
Yeah. And the way that I see risks is like risks are everywhere. I mean, I can walk outside my house right now, get into my car. I live in a small town, but that doesn't mean that because there's less population, I might not get, I could still get into a car accident. That car accident could still be fatal. I might have less of a risk, though, because I live in a small town where there's all of like three traffic lights. You have one lane either way. My risk is going to be very much lower than if I was going to Toronto, which then I've got multi-lane highways, lots of population. My risk is going to go higher. And so I think people have to recognize that the risk depends on also the situation we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Somebody's probably going to have more risk of issues if they're on a black market drug. Somebody's going to have more risks of issues if they have pre-existing health conditions. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to have more risks depending on duration of use and also volume of use. Mm-hmm. That when we think about these things, it has to be tailored to the individual state. And the individual is that's the person taking it. And that's why I always suggest people to, you know, take note. Like literally just take note of your body and your physiological state and track. Keep tracking, track, just like with women, how I track their menstrual cycle. Because
I don't know if it's, yeah, I mean, the one thing I have noticed with steroid users is they are very, very good at normalizing and ignoring a buildup of issues.
Absolutely.
It's only generally when they come out of the other side, they recognize how far down that road I've gone. I've experienced that myself. We've talked about this in the past, Scott.
Absolutely.
Where you disappeared down the drug rabbit hole. But even with side effects, where you start to feel shitty and you just normalize that. It just becomes what you feel like every day and you just don't think that that's not anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
So go on. I asked this before, so I'm going to ask it again because we weren't recording at the time. You know where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
Female PCT.
Yes.
And we'll wrap up on this topic.
Do you think that generally speaking, in usage terms, it's regarded that females don't need PCT because of the way their menstrual cycle works and their low levels of hormone, they are predispositioned to some degree to recover naturally easier than a male. That's the general conception. Would you agree with that? I'm not saying it's correct. I'm saying that's the general conception.
The general perception I get, Dave, is that women don't have balls, therefore they don't need to. That is what the rhetoric is on the like on the forums, on the bro knowledge, which is its own thing. But yes, I would agree.
I've met a few women that have got balls, by the way. Just
there's this general kind of idea that PCT has more to do with testicular stimulation and like gonadal
lady cell recovery and cell recovery. Yeah,
but women have gonads too. We don't have testicles, but we have ovaries.
Yes.
So
and your HPTA access is very, very similar in its basic function.
Absolutely.
Hypothalamus, pituitary, ovary. The only difference, and LH and FSH in the same way a male does.
Absolutely.
And you shut down the same way a male does.
Absolutely. Do you use the same protocols? No. Here's what I can say. For every action, there is a reaction. If we think about the term post-cycle therapy, if I was on a course of antibiotics, I would be doing my due diligence and making sure that I am helping with the implications of taking that drug, not only while I'm on that antibiotic, but when I go off that antibiotic. When we look at drug use, we have to think of it the same way. So female anabolic androgenic steroid use has to be looked at in the same way. There are certain things that can be done while you're on, and then there are certain things that can be done while you're off or going off. And that if I'm hesitant to call it, you know, female PCT, but yes, in a sense, that is what it is. You are doing certain actions to help provide a physiological basis to I almost want to say the word, like, reorganize your hypothalamus pituitary ovarian axis, but also your hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. Yes. And numerous other different organ states in your body. So absolutely, I am a huge proponent in female post-cycle management techniques, and that there are certain things that can be and shouldn't be ignored while an individual is on, especially females, say, on androgens, because if you can catch them before they get bad, say, such as virilization or hair growth, you can take radical action to dampen that from actually happening. Mm-hmm. Scott and I have talked about this a lot. It's as simple as managing inflammation, managing insulin resistance, because you know that being on an androgen is going to kickstart somebody, a female's body, into this very vicious cycle. So if you can start to manage it while you're on, it's going to make that process as you come off a hell of a lot smoother. Not only that, for women, they have to be mindful of ovulatory cycles, because mm-hmm. that's how we make most of our progesterone. And so until mm-hmm. we start to make progesterone again, we are not going to have a regulated HPO access. And mm-hmm. the implications of that are far, far reaching, over and beyond just androgen use. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a huge, huge, hugely important thing, not only for our bones, but just general health. And that
mm-hmm. in the same way as you would be with a male post cycle that's completely shut down. I mean, you know, that's obviously very detrimental to their health in lots of different ways. And just so people are aware, because some may not be, females actually produce a lot of their hormones outside of the ovaries, even the adrenal gland, or actually in tissue. So a lot of hormone conversion in females happens in tissue. It doesn't happen within the ovaries. So there's, whereas male hormone production, from the point of view of testosterone production, happens within the testes solely, apart from neural steroid production, which happens in the brain. Females have more mechanisms that actually get affected by androgen use, because they've got the adrenal gland production and they've got tissue conversion that's affected by that. What I found remarkable was, when I first started looking at female use, was the number of females that were suffering with androgen deficiency and hormone deficiency post-cycle, because they thought that's what they did. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you've got no hormones, so what you have gained from taking these anabolic drugs, you are now starting to lose because you can't support it, because you don't have hormone production, because you're still shut down. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked at the level of severity that some of women were experiencing, especially when it came to mental health with depression and anxiety post-usage, because they were so sensitive to the hormone fluctuations. And like you said, it's like looking at the individual. You do get women that are particularly sensitive to their menstrual cycle and are absolute rat bags when it comes to that time of month. Mm-hmm. You know damn well they're going to be problematic recoverers from steroids mm-hmm. when it comes to mood, because they're sensitive to these hormonal fluctuations, which is why they struggle with their menstrual cycle as it is in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things that go behind that. I mean, from anywhere from like serotonin and dopamine responses to thyroid issues to methylation. That's a huge thing. Do you actually have the trace nutrients that you need to function at a cellular level? Is your mitochondria been completely hijacked because you're totally deficient in certain vitamins, because those are the same vitamins that are getting leached because of your use? I mean, the body is so complicated.
The other aspect there as well is also diet with fat levels, because obviously we are looking at females that generally would be running a low fat diet with their androgen use, because they're in prep and comp, and then they're wondering why their hormone production is not recovering, because they've got no fat in the bloody diet.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that, like, you're inducing two different stressors simultaneously. And then this is a big issue that you see in the female athlete population, is that when we think of somebody who has something called secondary amenorrhea, so they don't have their period, often that can be equated to your hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis not necessarily issues with your hypothalamus pituitary ovarian axis. And so your hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, it gets interrupted because of just high stress load. So whether that is nutrient deficiencies, eating too much, eating too little, training too much, training too little, being in a very stressed out state because of some external factors, you're going to school, you've got financial issues, so on and so forth. So you're not only shutting down the HPA axis, but your HPO is also shut down because of the drug use. Then you go off thinking that everything is going to be, you know, hunky-dory and you're going to get your cycle back and everything's going to be fine. But the reality is you've now got two critical signals in your body that have been shut down that you have to nurture and you have to take care of in order to get them back. And throwing more hormones into the mix is often not the best course of action. And because I refer to this like you're throwing, you know, gasoline on the fire, because your body needs to have just the resources to manage these hormones. And it doesn't have those. Those have been ravaged by your use and by your stress and everything else.
Okay. I got to jump in because I want to, and this is where I know that, you know, I'm not going to try to pin you down to ask you what a female needs to do, you know, but we look at, you know, what's the protocol for a quote unquote PCT for a male? You know, we do, we get on Clomid, we get on, you know, Tamoxifen, we run this, we have this prefab cycle, HCG. This is like you go to any board and there's a plan. Now it sounds like there isn't going to be, there's not going to be a plan. Hold on a sec, Dave, because I know you're getting excited here because I think you're starting to think along the lines I am here. But what I'm looking for though is, you know, so women that are in this situation, what should they be evaluating to determine if they have recovered, if they have messed this up, and you know, how can they go about beginning to turn that around?
Before you answer, I'd just like to interject very, very slightly. Male PCT is far from ideal. We recognize that. But this comes back to that harm minimization is only effective if it can be implemented. So I'm going to put you even more on the spot here, because I don't want a scientific answer. I want a practical answer.
And I've got one. Okay. I've got this, actually.
All right.
Only because I've been asked this question many, many, many times. Okay, so there are some certain fundamental things that make humans healthy. And those are the things that, regardless of if you're a gear user or not, you should be doing. Because we know they have huge implications for our health. And in particular, since we're talking about hormones, our hormones. So sleep. Sleep is really important for hormone production. And if you're not sleeping, that is something relatively benign that you can begin to work on to be able to facilitate your hormone production and restorative hormone production. We know that testosterone production in our during sleep and when sleep gets disrupted, there has been a ton of research that has shown just how much your testosterone gets completely decimated. For cortisol levels for women, we know that cortisol has a huge impact on our progesterone. So ensuring that somebody is sleeping is something that is so basic of a thing that they can begin to look at. Stress levels. So, I mean, looking at if somebody is, you know, taking action to be able to do things like have fun, positive social relationships, coping strategies, they seem so basic, but we know the impact of that on the body. Exercising. So a little goes a long way, especially in a stressed out state. General liver health, drinking enough water, gut health. Are you having a bowel movement every single day? Because if you're not, that's a really important thing that you need to be doing to not only just have a generally healthy body, but in an environment of excess hormones to be able to get that out of your body. Inflammation is one of the biggest things that I see. So when people ask me, like, what are the biggest things you see with female users? It's four things in general: inflammation, nutrient deficiencies, insulin resistance, and dysbiosis of the microbiome. So when I say like PCT, so work on those four things. What are some steps that you can do to reduce your inflammation in your body? How can you start to restore nutrient deficiencies? And it doesn't involve, you know, going out and spending a couple $1,000s on supplements. Eat good food. Make sure you're actually digesting that food. If it's sitting like a lump in your stomach after you eat it, then maybe you've got to either switch up your sources or introduce, techniques that make you eat slower, because we know that that has an impact. Mm. Insulin resistance. So this is a really big component of female androgen use, because androgens love estrogens and estrogens love insulin. And you can get this really big clusterfuck started. So what are some steps for a female to be able to begin to manage insulin resistance? Well, the nice thing is inflammation and insulin resistance work together. And so by managing inflammation, you are also going to be working and addressing on insulin resistance. And dysbiosis of the microbiome, and this is a big one that you see, and the research on this is so new, but looking at the effects of estrogen on our actual mucosal lining, as well as the impact of progesterone on our actual digestive capacity. So for an individual, like I said, making sure that they're having a bowel movement. If they're bloating after every single meal, work on that. It doesn't need to be these grandiose kind of adding more hormones into the mix, because if you are, I've used this example probably even on this show or not show, but this network before, but if you have a house that has a cracked foundation, you wouldn't automatically go and put granite countertops in, because you probably would want to fix your foundation first. Especially if you lived in something like Tornado Alley and you know that you're going to have a tornado coming at you at any given time. For a steroid user, their foundation might be cracked. They might have already put this granite countertop in thinking that that would make them, feel better and everything else. But now that their house has been hit by some disaster, they hope they're going to go back and fix that foundation before going back and putting a new granite countertop in, hopefully. And that the foundation is things like sleeping, shitting every day, having fun, social relationships, eating good food. It doesn't need to be some extreme approach like, keto or carnivore or any of these things. Like, just eat a balanced diet. Start with the simple things.
Fair enough. Now, can I ask you, I didn't get to ask my question yet, Dave.
Sorry.
But what are the things that, they should be looking at to see, are these things off? For men, we just look at, we look at our blood levels. We look at, we say, okay, where's our testosterone at? Where's our estrogen at? Where's our free test? And then we end it there. Are there things that women should be looking at beyond that to see if steroids have thrown things off? And then from there, apply the tactics that you're talking about.
Well, for a female that is pre-menopausal, looking for ovulation. That's a big piece. So simply tracking their menstrual cycle can give them a lot of really rich data, even while they are on cycle. But particularly when they come off, because getting blood work is not going to tell them a whole hell of a lot. For women, we have to be able to look at our hormones in conjunction with where we are in our menstrual cycle. And if you have an irregular cycle, you can still track data and begin to see where there are certain influxes over time. So usually I don't recommend people get labs work for at least 3 months, because you've got to collect data first, and that data is your own. Okay. So tracking your menstrual cycle, basal temperature is a great tool to be able to see whether or not somebody's ovulating. And if they're ovulating, they're making progesterone. That is a great start, and it also will give you a foundation to now do lab work that's going to actually be accurate. Because if you go and get lab work done without that, it's really not going to be accurate. Now, if you're not ovulating, then you would do it where you see in your cycle. So say you see you're starting to get, I'm going to go there, but track your discharge. Like women, we should not ignore that we get discharge, because it is an incredibly valuable tool to help us understand what's going on with our menstrual cycle or anything else weird happening that could be there. So at different phases in a female's menstrual cycle, depending on her hormones, she's going to have different types of discharge when she, in her underwear. Yeah, it's a gross, PC kind of thing, but that is valuable data. If somebody's seeing that they're having cervical fluid, but they're not necessarily ovulating, well, that's a sign that something could be up, but that gives you a point in time that then you can calculate when's going to be the best time to get your labs done. Mm. So honestly, tracking is, it's such a simple way to get so much very valuable data, and that something like knowing if you ovulate is not only vital to your health, but to be able to actually begin to see what we need to do. Because I mean, the vast majority of individuals in the fitness industry, I can almost say for certain, they probably had some type of menstrual cycle dysfunction at some point in their life, because that's pretty normal for the population. So being able to get a handle on that is incredibly, incredibly vital, not only to something like managing their fat loss and making sure that they can lose fat, to being as healthy as they can if they're using. These are all little things that are so simple but so valuable. Another thing too is looking at even like hair growth. I mean, being really honest with yourself and going like, hey, I know I'm taking an androgen. Like, if I was hairy to start off with, so I have more hair than I once did, I recommend women to take pictures even. I mean, these are for their eyes only, but if they feel that they might get caught up in the swing of things, just take a freaking selfie. It's something so simple. Use the Fehrman-Galloway scale. That's the Fehrman-Galloway is an androgen index, and it essentially shows you like where somebody that has high levels of androgens, a female, might have excess androgens. And I recommend that certain users just use this scale and just every couple weeks put X's. Be honest with themselves. And if they see that that's changing rapidly, that means that there is something happening, because that hair growth, it's not a start. It is an end point of a whole bunch of different things happening in their body that then they need to go back and figure out how they can address that. And same thing with after use. If they're noticing that, like, you know, they've got really shitty energy, that they're not sleeping, that they have no desire to train. These are other markers that when you actually like be honest with yourself, which I know is hard for a lot of people, can give you very valuable information. But I can tell you that if you're going to go out and spend a couple $1,000s on lab work privately and you don't know if you're ovulating, good luck trying to get accurate results.
All right. Fair enough. Well, let's
Can I have one last question, please?
Sure, and then we'll give her a break, because we're starting to berate her. I think she needs a rest. You're going on Carl and Orr's show this week, aren't you?
Next week.
All right. What's up, Dave?
Rightly or wrongly, I have seen it used. I have even prescribed it myself. Is a chemical PCT for females, which is quite simply 50 milligrams of Clomid day 4, day 8 of menstrual cycle. What are your thoughts on that? Now, it's been very successful, but I'd like your thoughts on that.
There are ways to not use chemicals to kickstart a female's menstrual cycle. I mean, there are many different ways to do that. So first and foremost, I would not use that type of approach personally and professionally if somebody wasn't able to first metabolize estrogen properly. So if their liver is completely kaputs and if they aren't having regular digestion, I would not kickstart somebody's menstrual cycle, because you don't know what's going to come as a result of that. Keeping in mind that estrogen recirculates, and keeping in mind that our liver is a major, major place for hormone metabolism. So that's something that I would always caution people for. Same thing with using, say, Vitex, which is a natural way to help promote ovulation, or black coalish. There are ways that we can set this up in a menstrual cycle, but the first thing is number one, can they handle that? Unfortunately, there are even things like autoimmune, like Hashimoto's, so autoimmune hypothyroid issues that can happen when somebody has not ovulated for, like, say, 20-something years. They were on birth control for 10 years, then they had kids, they didn't have an ovulatory cycle, then they got into bodybuilding, then they ran gear for, you know, 4 or 5 years, didn't have ovulatory cycles, to then go and say, like, okay, let's kickstart this. Your body's not going to know what to do. So you have to keep that in mind when you're thinking about like kickstarting somebody's HPO access. Also things like, one of the things I recommend, if somebody hasn't had an ovulatory period for a while, see if you can get your MD to do an ovarian ultrasound. Because if you have, say, some type of ovarian cyst or thickened endometrium, and then you start also adding in these excess hormones, it can be a very scary breeding ground for things like ovarian cancer, for things like cervical cancer, for things like, just different variations of cysts. So I think that these types of protocols, sure, they might be good. I mean, I can get somebody, you know, fertility-wise, I can get a female fertile. I can make her period come away. I can make her period go. There's many different ways to do this, even using natural things. But the thing is you've got to look at it in conjunction with the individual. And we're now starting to discover things like even menstrual hypersensitivity in individuals that haven't had a menstrual cycle, like an ovulatory cycle, in a while. And that progesterone hypersensitivity is because their body just doesn't know what this hormone is. And so when mm-hmm. they do have higher levels of progesterone in their body, all of a sudden it's like, what do I do with this? Mm-hmm. And that's a very scary process for a female going through that, especially if she's also not comfortable with her body composition at that time. Mm-hmm. Because there's going to be things like massive amounts of fluid retention, which I can speak from personal experience. It's terrifying to be in that place.
Okay. No, just curious, because I say I have seen it used. I've even used it myself with actually surprising success. But
yeah,
I knew it was a bit of a Heath Robinson yeah. approach.
Yeah.
And I was curious as to the yeah. you know, the more in depth implications yeah. of that.
Well, like, I mean, I've seen women on cycle before, so on a very like mild dose of say Anavar for 16 weeks or so. Pre-contest, their coach added in Novadex. And all of a sudden, once Novadex got it added in, they had a regular cycle for the first time. Now, it was not an ovulatory cycle, but they had a regular bleed mm-hmm. while they were still on Anavar. And then when they went off Anavar, stayed on Novadex, they continued to have that regular bleed because their hormonal state was already in disarray before they started on these drugs. Mm. But then utilizing Novadex in that way then led to other things. I mean, it led to diminished some issues with bone density. It led to issues with different types of cysts. It led to some issues with endometriosis. And you know, this is the thing about, I mean, women's health research when it comes to hormones, there is so many unknown variables that mm-hmm. I always say, like, go with a grain of salt. Like, you've got to be cautious because, like, male or female coaches that are prescribing or recommending certain hormonal drugs, you need to recognize you might not realize this, but that individual might not be able to be fertile for the rest of their life if it's done irresponsibly. Hmm. And do you really want to take that into your own hands to be able to know that somebody can't have a child because of reckless?
It's male-based, but I'll get at least one, if not two, a week that are now infertile and having to come to terms with that. And generally, it's me that has to tell them that you're fucked. Yeah. And the level of or the level at which some of them struggle to accept that they are now infertile is difficult, very difficult for some people, and they will come back to you day in, day out for weeks on end. What if I do this? What if I do that? What if I do this? I'm sorry, but what you're telling me and what you've tried and what you've gone through, you need to go and seek fertility, but I still then doubt you'll ever recover. Because you know, you're not your sperm count's zero, your hormone production's zero. You've done 3 PCTs. You've even tried treptorolin, and you're still not getting anything. So I think it's safe to say you are shut down. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they now have to face a life of TRT and potential fertility issues is absolutely devastating for them. And it's like, well, didn't you think this before you started? And it comes back to that knowledge thing, doesn't it? You know, taking informed decisions and knowing the risks you're taking because you've got knowledge about what you can potentially do to yourself, even on a base level.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's get out of here. I'm glad I got a chance to introduce you guys. It looks like you probably have a lot more to talk about, Dave. If we can probably keep going for another hour.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely, but I've had a message 45 minutes ago that my tea's on table, so I'm
Trouble
as it is anyway.
Do you guys microwave tea in the UK? Is that a thing? Or I imagine that you shouldn't, like, that's not, that would be like an American thing to do, microwaving your tea to heat it back up.
I'm not on about tea as in the drink. I'm on about tea as in the meal.
What is this? It comes in a cup. You put tea.
No.
Drink it, Dave. No. You drink it.
Depending on whether you're Southern or Northern, you have breakfast, dinner, and tea. Some people have breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah.
But to me, dinner is at 12 and tea is my evening meal.
Oh, okay.
So my evening meal, but we also drink tea as well. Yes.
Okay. Well, in that case, we're making Dave late for dinner. So
so if you go for tea, you don't go for a cup of tea. You go to eat a meal, an evening meal.
I see. Huh. Did you know that, Victoria?
I just learned something new.
Yeah, me too.
I'm teaching him English. He's a slow learner. He's getting there very, very slowly, but he is getting there.
See, I'm Canadian, so I'm kind of in the middle.
Well, that's even worse, isn't it?
We still say some things from our roots. And I know, Scott, I've said some certain things that he looks at me funny. I'm the odd one out.
They're all ice cube farmers, aren't they? It's Canadians.
Dave, did you,
there's an ice cube farmers, yep.
When you were in Canada, Dave, did you ever have they do maple syrup over snow? Have you tried that? It's a thing they do there. It was like right where you were living too in Canada.
I experienced my first ice storm in Canada. That was quite surreal. I've never seen anything like that before in my life since either. I've never seen anything that since. I love Canada. It's a beautiful country. Absolutely adore Canada.
All right. Well, let's get out of here. Thank you very much, Victoria, for being with us. We much appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. For another episode of Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland and special guest Victoria Felkar, you can go over to crosslands.org.uk. Reach out to Dave for a mass building plan. And, of course, go to our sponsor, TrueNutrition.com. You can use our code over there, Advices. All right, guys, we will see you soon.